Bahrain is to hold parliamentary elections on November the 24th. The validity of the vote, however, has been thrown into question following a ban on opposition parties and jailed activists. The ruling monarchy has launched a heavy-handed crackdown on dissent since 2011 when pro-democracy protests began. An international human rights group, Human Rights Watch, says Bahrain's repressive political environment is not conducive to free elections. The advocacy group says Manama supporters should not give Bahrain a free pass and conduct business as usual while mass rights abuses persist. That and more on tonight's debate.
This is the second time since 2011 that Bahrain holds elections for parliament or the Council of Representatives. There are 40 seats up for grabs. Bahrain's current parliament approved a law in May barring members of dissolved political parties from running in the elections.
Candidates should not be one of the leaders and members of the actual political societies dissolved by a final judgment for committing a serious violation of the provisions of the kingdom's constitution or any of its laws.
Bahrain dissolved two major opposition parties of Al-Wefaq and the National Democratic Action Society in 2016, arresting a large number of their leaders, members and supporters. Human rights groups have reacted to the ban on the opposition from even being nominated.
By jailing or silencing people who challenge the ruling family and banning all opposition parties and independent news outlets, Bahrain is failing to create the conditions necessary for a free election.
A group of lawmakers in the UK, the US, the EU and Ireland have called on Bahrain to end repression and allow free and fair elections.
Upcoming parliamentary elections in Bahrain have been deprived of any legitimacy by a ban on opposition parties. Free and fair elections can only take place if citizens are able to express their views.
Bahrain's electoral infrastructure inherently disadvantages the political opposition. There is no independent electoral commission, and to date, the government has not permitted any international or domestic election monitors. The 2018 vote comes at a sensitive time for the Persian Gulf monarchy. Tensions have shown no sign of abating with the UN and rights group accusing the government of crushing dissent. Just in November, a court sentenced opposition leader Sheikh Ali Salman to life in prison. It also stripped Sheikh Isa Qasim, another outspoken critic of the kingdom, of his citizenship and sentenced him to jail. Thousands of anti-regime protesters have been holding frequent demonstrations in Bahrain ever since a popular uprising began in the country in mid-February 2011. Scores of people have lost their lives and hundreds of others sustained injuries or got arrested as a result of the Al-Khalifa regime's crackdown. The protesters are demanding that the royal family relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established. But their calls have so far fallen on deaf ears, and Manama, emboldened by the West's unrelenting support, has gone to great length to clamp down on any sign of dissent.
Well, joining us on tonight's debate, we have founder of American Institute for Foreign Policy, Mr. Michael Lane, joining us from Washington, D.C., and also former U.S. diplomat in Saudi Arabia, Mr. Michael Springman, also joining us from D.C. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Michael Lane. Mr. Lane, the elections on November the 24th are occurring in a repressive political environment that is not conducive to free elections. What are your thoughts about the upcoming parliamentary elections in Bahrain?
Well, there certainly are a number of very important questions about, number one, who had access to the ballot, who was allowed to run as a candidate, what issues they were allowed to talk about, etc. I think when you look at the bigger picture, step back a bit and look at the bigger picture, we're talking about a part of the world where their style of democracy is in no way close to what we define democracies like in Western democracies. Ours are characterized, but what we like to think are open, fair, and free elections. And when you compare and contrast what's going on in Bahrain to the way we just conducted our elections here in the United States, I think there's no comparison. I think you can say that this is a very restrictive environment, and I think that you can say that the kingdom is doing its best to ensure that it will continue to wield the power that it has for any number of decades.
Michael Springman, boycotting the opposition political parties and jailed activists doesn't really go hand in hand with the concept of the so-called free elections, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, it's an oxymoron. If you have an election, you have at least two sides in opposition to the issues of the day. And if one side is forbidden to run because their parties have been dissolved and their leaders have been jailed, it's absolute insanity to call it an election. You can't have one side running for office and not have another side running for office, at least in, if you want to claim any kind of democracy, if you want to claim any kind of democratic basis to your society, you've got to get people out of jail and let them run in opposition and present an alternative form of view towards the government. But apparently the Al-Khalifa family is desperately afraid of any kind of opposition, and they have put people in jail, in fact, for defacing campaign posters by the allowed government candidates, and somehow comes down to a charge of obstructing the election, which is astonishing as far as I'm concerned.
Mr. Lane, let's talk about the jailed activists and opposition leaders, both Shia and Sunni. Most notably, we can mention Al-Wafaq leader Sheikh Ali Salman. These individuals have mostly been tried in military courts. There's a big question mark over the fairness of this entire process. Why were they even tried in military courts in the first place? And are these people getting the proper legal representations at these hearings?
Well, I can't actually speak to whether or not they received the proper legal representation at these hearings. But the charges against Sheikh Salman and some of his contemporaries were essentially that they were conspiring with foreign enemies of the Bahraini government and therefore were treasonous and were pursuing policies antithetical to the success of the kingdom. They had a court, they had a trial, they presented evidence, and the court convicted the opposition and said that, yes, we have seen enough evidence to conclude that they are conspiring with the enemies of the government, and so therefore they dissolved the political parties or political associations, societies that were in opposition to the government, and they jailed many of the leaders. I think there's a lot of very, very valid questions you can ask as to how independent and fair those trials were, how independent and fair those courts are. But under the way that Bahrain processes these things, they at least, you know, checked every box and punched each ticket at the top.
Mr. Springman, do you agree with Mr. Lane with regards to what many believe to be sham trials in kangaroo courts being held against the opposition in Bahrain?
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I might expand it a little bit. The reason why they're using military courts instead of civilian courts is that you have much more control. You have a chain of command in the armed forces, and if you want to advance and make the next level up and retire with a fat pension, you do what the higher-ups tell you to do, and if they tell you to find this man guilty, no matter what the evidence, no matter what the charges are, then you do so. Whereas with a civilian court, you still might have a maverick judge who would law and look at the real evidence and make a decision based on what he sees as what the law is rather than what some people would like it to be.
And Mr. Springman, tell us more about the role of Saudi Arabia in all of this. How much support is Manama getting from Riyadh?
Well, I'd imagine they're still getting it. They were saved from their own people by the Saudis invading over the causeway some 7 years ago. So I think that they think alike and they act alike. Certainly, Bahrain is involved in the outrageous war against Yemen. The Americans in 2017, the State Department approved $3.5 billion in sales of weapons to Bahrain, including F-16 fighters, patrol boats, and missile systems. And just a couple of weeks ago, the United States Senate voted down a resolution condemning this and allowing a sale of $300 million worth of missile systems to go through to Bahrain. So I think Bahrain and Saudi Arabia are two peas in a pod. They're engaged in the horrific war against Yemen, and they support each other. They're both autarkies. They're both governments that do not have the will of the people behind them. And I think that if the Saudis are not giving them overt support, certainly there is plenty of covert support being provided.
Mr. Lane, your thoughts on Saudi Arabia's involvement and complicity in events taking place in Bahrain?
Well, I agree with Mr. Springman that the Saudis are probably, providing support and assistance to keeping them in. They're allies. They're going to do what they can do in order to keep their coalition together. And that would include supporting the government when it comes under pressure from outside sources, even when it's domestic political outside sources. So it doesn't surprise me that the Saudis would be providing support and assistance to the monarchy. And it doesn't support me that the monarchy would be returning the favor to the Saudi monarchy in some way. The fact of the matter is, when we compare all of this activity and the way they conduct business affairs and foreign policy affairs in that corner of the world, and try and compare that to Western democracies, there's not even a comparison. It's an entirely different place, entirely different rules. And although the United States would probably like to see Western-style openness and Western-style democracies spread throughout the world, I think we conclude that that kind of pressure from at least the current administration is not going to be forthcoming in any organized fashion.
Mr. Lane, staying with you, why doesn't the U.S. Or Britain ever condemn what is happening in Bahrain? Why are they, behaving as if business as usual with Bahrain?
Well, condemn is a interesting word. Some people would argue that it's pretty clear what it means. Others would say, well, maybe it means criticize, a lot of different things. The fact is, several years ago, under the Obama administration, the United States government and the UK government, I believe, did condemn or criticize or issue statements about what Bahrain had been doing in terms of eliminating the opposition or censoring the opposition, saying that they really didn't want to see us go down that road. But the fact of the matter is, Bahrain is one of our close allies in the region. When you criticize a friend, you pull your punches a little bit, particularly when you're doing so publicly. I think we see that on today's stage when, although everyone is of a affirmative belief that Saudi Crown Prince bin Salman was likely behind the Khashoggi assassination, nonetheless, President Trump is muting his criticism of the regime and of the Crown Prince in an effort to maintain the relationship with both the monarchy and with the Crown Prince himself. The same thing on a much lesser scale now goes to our relationship with Bahrain. They're our friend, they're our ally, and whatever criticism we're going to be coming forth with is going to be muted in public and probably downplayed in private.
Mr. Springman, your thoughts on the lack of condemnation coming from major Western allies towards Bahrain. What is it that the U.S. Is fearing the most when it comes to criticizing Bahrain?
Well, I don't think anybody has criticized Bahrain in the American government or even outside the American government, except perhaps Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International. The United States and the British, of course, love Bahrain because it's a source of weapon sales. It's a base for the American Fifth Fleet in the Persian Gulf. There are 7,800 Americans ashore in Bahrain to support the fleet, and there's some 20,000 sailors and Marines in the fleet itself, plus maybe 20 ships or so. It's American force in the region, and America likes to have its bases and its forces projected around the world, supposedly in this case to counter the threat of Iran, which in my view is totally imaginary and is cooked up to justify the existence of American weapons and arms in parts of the world where they don't belong.
Mr. Lane, why we mentioned the lack of condemnation coming from Western countries, but what about the Western media and the blackout that it has on the situation in Bahrain? The crackdown, the arrest, the outrageous prison sentences, none of this is being reported by the mainstream media.
No, it's not. And I think the answer is pretty simple. It's not the kind of thing that the American people understand. The American people don't even understand why Bahrain is important. If you asked the average person on the street why the United States was an ally of Bahrain, they would, 9 out of 10 would fail to mention the home of the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain that Mr. Springman just mentioned. So it's not a particularly high-profile place. Of all these stories in all the world for people to get educated about and excited about and to learn about, it may be a violation of the political rights of minority parties in Bahrain, but it doesn't rise to the level of making news here in America.
Mr. Springman, your thoughts on the media blackout of what's taking place or what has been taking place in Bahrain over the past years?
Well, in the United States, news media are not quite news and not quite media. It's more entertainment. And to give you an example, just yesterday on Thanksgiving holiday, the TV news consisted of the crowds expected to buy all sorts of Christmas presents today called Black Friday, when they supposedly can get great deals, and the weather in Washington, D.C. There was no news about the rest of the world. Europe or South Asia or Latin America could have disappeared overnight, and it wouldn't make the news until maybe a month later. The focus on American news is not news. It's basically simplistic things like a feel-good story about a soldier home from the wars who meets his family who weren't expecting him, so that there's no real substance to what is being given the American people. They're being kept ignorant, I think, of what's really going on. It almost seems like it's a conspiracy to make sure the American people know exactly nothing about the rest of the world and very little about their own political system.
Mr. Lane, would you like to add anything to that?
You know, not a lot. It is a sad commentary on the average American's knowledge of international affairs, of the interests of the United States, and how we conduct our foreign policy. I don't know that that's new. I think it's something that's probably been going on for a long time. And I, too, watched the news yesterday, and I, too, saw nothing but stories about going shopping for today on Black Friday leading into the Christmas season. It's not news.
Well, the popular uprising, Mr. Lane, has mostly been the Bahraini people protesting in unison, but observers have described the brutal crackdowns as a form of quote-unquote sectarian apartheid and sectarian cleansing, if you will. Do you think that the Al Khalifa regime took advantage of the situation to forward its crackdown along those so-called sectarian lines?
Well, I haven't seen any reports. I may have missed them, I'll grant you that, but I haven't seen any reports that the crackdown is really widespread among the Shia people of Bahrain. It's the leaders that they're putting in jail, because the leaders are the one who organize the dissidents. They're the ones who organize the people to come together, the ones who organize the political parties, etc. So as far as apartheid or something like that is concerned, I don't see what I see as rising to that level. It's more of just a regime trying to stay in power. Look, when I went to the university, I studied political science, and I learned that the first thing you do when you're in power is you never cede power to the opposition unless you're forced to. I believe that the monarchy is simply holding on to power, and they're not willing to cede power to the opposition, no matter who they are.
Mr. Springman, what do you think about the issue? I believe that it does go a little deeper than that when we look at the revocation of the citizenship of so many Shia Bahrainis over the past years with the crackdowns.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, you've got the government composed mostly of Sunni, and most of the population composed of the Shia branch of Islam. And I think that the Al-Khalifa family should read Niccolo Machiavelli, the 16th century Italian political commentator, when he said in The Prince that the prince should take care, if he wants to keep his throne, not to ally himself with the great men of his kingdom or of the outside powers, but to ensure that his people feel safe and secure, and the property is safe and secure, and they have enough to eat, and that they feel comfortable. And in that way, he will ensure the greatest good for the greatest number. And the Al-Khalifa family seems to do the opposite, the greatest good for the fewest number, mainly the Al-Khalifa family and his hangers-on. And they seem to spend all their time trying to make sure that the Shia opposition never really becomes reality, and make sure that they can push them out of the country, take their citizenship away, or jail them. And there's going to be a limit to this, and they can't put the entire country in jail. And sooner or later, the situation is going to blow up.
Mr. Lane, let's go back to June 2011, when the Bahraini king launched the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, also known as the Al-Basyuni Commission. That commission confirmed the Bahraini government's use of systematic torture and other forms of physical, psychological abuse on detainees, as well as other human rights violations. But we're about 8 years on, and the situation hasn't pretty much changed a bit.
No, you know, historically, human rights has not been a characteristic of many of the regimes in that area of the world. We all know that human rights are pretty dismal throughout any number of countries in that region. It doesn't surprise me that there would be continued accusations of human rights violation on a widespread basis.
And Mr. Springman, we can get a final thought from you. How far are the Al-Khalifas willing to go to quell these demonstrations?
I think there's no limit as long as he has the backing of the United States and Great Britain. He's got the money, he's got the weapons, and he's trying to exert his control over a bit more than a million people. And sooner or later, he's going to come to the end of the road. He will do his best to stay in power at whatever cost, but it's eventually going to cost him his head.
Well, that's all the time we have for tonight's debate. Allow me to thank my guests, founder of American Institute for Foreign Policy, Mr. Michael Lane, joining us from Washington, D.C. And also many thanks to former U.S. diplomat in Saudi Arabia, Mr. Michael Springman, joining us also from Washington, D.C. And with that, I'd also like to thank you, our viewers, for joining us in tonight's debate. That's all for now. Bye, everybody.